normalized Gaussian distribution. So we got the, that's the 2-point. So the problem is, once you become a quantum field theorist, it's very hard to think of classical probability. I want to call this a 2-point function, but of course it's the standard deviation squared, I suppose, isn't it, in classical language. And yeah, so it's normalized to have probability 1 if you integrate over all of zeta. Okay, so the properties of a Gaussian distribution. Now, let's put it up here, shall we? So it's useful to look at the moments. So first of all the odd moments vanish. And all the even moments are just related to the two-point two-point function is what I want to call it. Second moment. Just to put this in equations, what we mean by moment, of course, is the expectation value of the field raised to some power. So the second moment is just the expectation value of zeta squared, third moment is the expectation value of zeta cubed, and so forth. So you just integrate up zeta to the power times the probability distribution P of z, P of zeta, and zeta runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. If you just work this out for Gaussian, you may have seen this before, but if not, it's fun to do it. I'm just going to raise that. Yeah, so first of all, we find if M is odd, it vanishes. In fact, you can see that obviously just by symmetry. You know, this will be odd, whereas this Gaussian distribution is even under zeta goes to minus zeta. So all the odd moments vanish, and the even moments, when you do the integral, you find they're just given by this factor here. Sorry, that's the x. Yep, factorial. Times the second moment to the power n. So this is for m equals 2n even. Okay. Okay, so that was just classical probability. We're interested in field theory in this class here. So we're going to look now, let's have a look now at what happens in quantum field theory. Okay, so rather than having a classical variable zeta, we're going to have a field. So zeta is going to become a function of position, zeta of x, and it's going to become an operator. So let's look at the, so last time we saw that basically inflation, we're looking at free fields starting off in a vacuum state. So let's just look at correlation functions of free quantum field theories in their vacuum state. So, the correlators are free QFTs, free meaning no interactions. In the vacuum state. Okay, so we have some operator zeta. If we're talking about free fields, it's best, life is much easier to work in momentum space when you've got free fields because the Hamiltonian is diagonal. So if we think about a momentum space, we saw last time that we could write the quantum operator for zeta in momentum space like this. There was a mode function, which was a function of time, and then there was this creation, there was this annihilation operator, and then there was a complex conjugate. There was like the mode function, complex conjugate, and then there's a creation operator here. So when we quantize the perturbations of inflation, we had an expression like this for the quantized field in momentum space. And okay, so we had the canonical. Let's raise that. Yeah, so we have the canonical commutation relations, as always. And if we're talking about something in its vacuum state, then of course the creation operator, the annihilation operator hitting the vacuum vanishes. And of course, if you permission conjugate that the other way around, you have a dagger acting on the vacuum also vanishes. Yeah, you've seen this before, of course. Yeah, so it's okay. So the idea is just... So you can show very similar properties. So this is a little exercise. So basically show... So first of all... So correlators of an odd number of zetas vanish. Odd number... The zetas vanish. If you've never done that, so something like a three-point function, for example. So you've probably seen this before in your QFT courses, but I mean, if you've never done it before, it's really good fun just to do these exercises. If you just plug the expression for the field here into the correlator. And then you can use the commutation relation multiple times to contract out the fields in pairs. So if you have an expression with an odd number of zetas inside, you find you have an odd number of creation and annihilation operators. And you know the only way to get a non-zero answer is that you have to have an even number of creation and annihilation operators so you can contract them together in pairs using this to get a non-zero answer. So just try doing it. You know, if you have an odd number of zetas, such as 3, you find you get left with an odd number of creation and annihilation operators, and eventually you'll wind up, after commuting operators using the commutator, you'll find you end up with something like this. Two of the three sets of creation and annihilation operators. Each zeta has one creation, one annihilation operator. If you expand the whole thing out, you'll get a bunch of terms, each of which contains three operators, creation and annihilation operators. Two of them will commute or contract together, and then you get left with one left over, which will hit the vacuum and give you 0. So if you just try plugging that in and playing with this relation, you can show that all odd correlators vanish. Even correlators, basically, they're all related to the two-point function by Wick's theorem. So hopefully you've seen this before in your QFT classes. I'm sure you have. If you just try and compute, let's say you try and compute a four-point function. So zeta q1, zeta q2, zeta q3, zeta q4. When I don't put anything here, it's just assumed that it's in the vacuum state here. You know, we usually just don't bother to write all these zeros because it's just extra work. So something like a four-point function, ditto with all these hats to remind you it's an operator. I mean, we often don't bother writing them, right? Yeah, so if you try and work this guy out here, so again, you will have seen this in your QFT class, but essentially there are 4 points here, Q1, Q2, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and there's basically 3 different ways of contracting these guys together in pairs. You could contract like that, or you could contract 1, 2, 3, 4. You could contract like that. And the other way of doing it is the cross combination. So you can contract that guy with that guy, and that one like that. So if you just plug in this expression, use the canonical commutation relations, you can show that this guy here is given by a product of two-point functions. Zeta q1, zeta q2, times zeta q3, zeta q4. So this guy here is this term here. It's 1 contracted with 2 and 3 contracted with 4. And then there's 2 other terms. One of them is given by swapping 2 and 3 around. And one of them is given by swapping 2 and 4 around. Yeah, so, if you've probably seen something very similar to this in your QFT course. If not, don't worry. All you need to do is just plug in this expression here and use the canonical commutation relations, and you find that basically what happens is you contract operators together in pairs to get delta functions, and what you'll end up with is these products of two-point functions here. So graphically, you can think about it like this, you know, sort of Feynman diagrams. So the four-point function, you've got 4 points, and you've got to contract them together in pairs, and there's three ways of doing that. And each way, you know, that corresponds to one two-point function here, and this factor here corresponds at one and two, that corresponds to that two-point function there. Three and four, that corresponds to that two-point function there. Yes, this is just Wick's theorem, right? Okay, so we talked about free QFT. So we've seen that basically correlators of odd numbers of zetas vanish, correlators of even numbers of zeta, they're all given by powers of two-point functions of zeta. Now, when we were talking on the top about properties of Gaussianity, we were talking about the moments. So, you know, whereas here we're talking about correlators in momentum space. So what I want to do now is look at the moments. So we have to go back to position space. So moments, so I'm talking about something like, let's say look at the fourth moment, that's the expectation value of zeta to the power 4 in position space. So, you know, here we were just talking about correlators in momentum space, now I want to Fourier transform back to position space. So this is like the fourth moment of the field in position space. So to get this, we just have to do a Fourier transform of our four-point function over there. So why I'm interested in moments is I'm trying to make a connection with our original definition of Gaussianity for this classical random field. And now I'm talking about quantum field theory, so I want to say, what is the moment of a quantum field? Okay, so we just do the Fourier transform. Okay. So there are four momenta, so I'm just going to write it like this. So it's going to be a product from 1 to 4 of so be that factor there, and then I've got the correlator of momentum space. So I've got zeta of q1, zeta of q2, zeta of q3, zeta of q4, e to the I, and then I'm going to sum all the momenta, dotted with my English vector. Okay, so that's just a Fourier transform. So we're just doing inverse Fourier transform. There's four momenta, so there's four integrals to do here. And because we're looking at the four-point function all evaluated at one point, you know, rather than having x1, x2, x3, and x4, we're just evaluating all at a single point. So we've just got a single factor of x here. Okay, so that's just a Fourier transform. Let's plug in our result there now. So good. Yeah, so let's just plug in that result there. All right, then, line two. So I'm being quite pedestrian here, just going through this very slowly, but I just wanted to give you a really secure understanding of what we mean by Gaussianity for a quantum field. So I'm just going to plug in. So there we saw that the four-point function is just product of two-point functions. So let's just write it like this. So we, first of all, we have that zeta q1, zeta q2. And let's pull out two of the momenta from this factor here, e to the I q1 and q2 dot x. And then the second term was this one here, zeta q3, zeta q4. D3Q4 over 2pi, 6, so that's a 6. You can probably guess the answer already, but, oops. And there are two other terms, the ones where you swap Q2 and Q3 around, and there was this other term where you swap Q2 and Q4 around. Just save me writing them out, I put them like that. Okay, so all I've done is the fourth moment in position space, it's the inverse Fourier transform, and we just saw it there using Wick's theorem that the four-point function can be written as a product of two-point functions. Okay? And yeah, so the final step is, you know, if you just look at this here, you can see that this is just the, you know, this is just zeta squared of x in position space, this term here. You know, this is just the inverse Fourier transform itself, and there's only one x here, so we just end up with one x here. And similarly for this guy here, you know, this is also just the inverse Fourier transform with both points set to x. And then we've got another two terms here, you know, plus that term. So overall, you can see we just get 3 times the two-point function squared. Those are twos. So in a sense, you know, actually this isn't so hard to guess, is it, right? You know, we've got the four-point function, we're going back to position space, you've got 3 times a two-point function squared, you inverse Fourier transform, and what we get is 3 times that's two-point function in position space squared. Okay, I'll go over here. Okay, so that was for the four-point function. What happens when you have an n-point function for n even? So in general, yeah, so in general what we find is if we look at the moment, let's look at the 2nth moment of the field, then what we find is we get a factor. So we get the two-point function, the second moment, and you know, we've got two n's here, so it gets raised to the power n. And then you get a numerical factor. So you know, if you compare that with this result here, you know, we've got 4 zetas here, we've got 4 zetas there, and then there's this numerical factor. So what is this numerical factor in general? So basically, the numerical factor counts the number of contractions, number of different Wick contractions. So you saw here, you know, we had 4 points, and we have to contract them together in pairs. And there are basically 3 different ways of doing this. And the point is, you know, we don't care about the ordering within a pair, and we don't care about the ordering of the pairs themselves. So number of Wick, let's raise this. Okay, so the number of contractions. Yeah, so this is the number of distinct Wick contractions. But we don't count the ordering of the pairs. So not counting or the ordering within a pair. Within pairs, I suppose. Right, so okay, so if I give you 2n zetas, you know, first of all, there are 2n factorial permutations of those zetas. So first of all, there's a factor 2n factorial for the ordering of 2n zetas. So permutations, perms of 2n zetas. But we don't care about the ordering of the pairs, so that's a factor of n factorial. And I don't care about the ordering within pairs. So, you know, there are n pairs. So we've got 2n objects, we contract them together to form pairs. You know, there are therefore n pairs, and each pair can be either this way around or that way around. So you've got a factor of 2 for each of the n pairs, and that's 2 to the power n. So we've overcounted by a factor of 2 to the power n here, due to the ordering within pairs. So when I'm saying pairs, I suppose, you know, maybe one way of thinking about this is you've got, you know, zeta 1, zeta 2, zeta 3, zeta 4, say, you know, let's look at this example here. You sort of have zeta 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you can form, you could have like zeta 1, zeta 2, zeta 3, zeta 4, or you could have had another, you know, you could have zeta 1, zeta 3, zeta 2, zeta 4, or you could have had zeta 1, zeta 4, zeta 2, zeta 4. So, you know, these are the three distinct ways of forming Witt contractions. And, you know, I don't care whether you list this guy first or that guy first, it's all the same. And similarly, I don't care, you know, this is the same thing as zeta 2, zeta 1, zeta 3, zeta 4. You know, so I don't care about the ordering within a pair, and I don't care about whether you put that pair first or that pair first. So, you know, if you try and do this problem in general, to count the number of different distinct Witt contractions, not caring about the ordering within the pair or the ordering of the pairs, you know, the numerical factor you get here is this one here. Okay, so this is a general definition of a Gaussian random field. We mean one where all the odd correlators vanish, all the even correlators related to the two-point function, and they're related by this formula here. The nth moment for an even number of zetas is given by the two-point function raised to the appropriate power, and then there's a numerical factor which just counts the number of distinct Witt contractions. And so it's just given by 2 to the n factorial over 2 to the n times n factorial. If you put n as 2, you should get back 3 we have there. Okay, so the conclusion is that correlators of a free field in the vacuum are Gaussian. And what this means, all odd correlators vanish. I'm just going to write it like this, odd point, PT for point. All odd point correlators vanish. And all the even point correlators just related to the two-point function by this formula here. So they're fully determined by the two-point function. Once you know the two-point function, you know all the correlators of the field. Two-point Fn function. So far we've been talking about disconnected correlators. If you look at these diagrams, you know, you can split them up into two disjoint diagrams. So these are all disconnected correlators. Another way of saying all this is to look at connected correlators. So for a Gaussian random field, all the connected correlators vanish except for the two-point function. So all the higher correlators, they're all made by contracting together points in pairs. So therefore, they're all disconnected diagrams. So that the connected diagrams, basically, they all vanish except for the two-point function. So another way of... I have the same problem in supermarkets, you know, the plastic bags pinning apart the layers. Yeah, so another way of stating Gaussianity is basically that all the higher connected correlators vanish. So all higher connected correlators vanish. So higher meaning higher than 2. All higher connected correlators vanish. So higher here meaning n is greater than 2. So 3 point, 4 point, 5 point, 6 point, they will vanish, right?
Could you just write down what you mean by higher connected correlators?
Well, actually, usually we write connected correlators just by putting like a small c after the correlator.
So
basically, just the definition that you sort of subtract off the connected piece, subtract off the disconnected pieces. So, for example, the four-point connected correlator We're sort of going around the circle slightly, but yes, you might write it with a C, for example. Normally, you just say, normally when you're writing a paper, it's kind of clear from the context where you're talking about connected or disconnected. You might often, if it's ambiguous, you might just say, we compute disconnected correlators. But you could put it, so for example, it will be given by the, so basically it'll be given by the full disconnected one minus the So it'd be given by the like the disconnected one minus minus all the minus all these guys basically. So basically Wick's theorem essentially computes the disconnected correlators. Or rather it just computes the full correlator, not caring whether your diagrams are connected or disconnected. So in fact all these diagrams here are disconnected. And then the definition of a connected correlator is basically just that you subtract off all the...
My question is really, how can you tell from the maths which diagram, which terms are disconnected and which terms are connected?
Yeah, it's funny. It's sort of going between the diagram language and the actual expression. But I suppose, so if we had this expression here, this guy here sort of diagrammatically corresponds to this line here. And then there's a separate factor here. So I suppose that's right. So since it's a product, isn't it? That's right. Yeah. So
then the left-hand side
the left-hand side is the full four-point function, and we've written it as a sum of product of two-point functions. So I suppose the disconnected, if you've got a diagram that's made up of disconnected pieces, that'll appear as products of smaller correlators of small numbers of operators. Yeah, I guess that's probably a good way to think about it, isn't it? So this is a product of two-point functions. And you plus similar terms.
Can I ask a slightly related question? So, would it be correct to say that there are no connected diagrams if I don't have interactions?
Yes, that's where I'm heading to. Yeah. So in fact, that's sort of where I'm going to. So, if there are no, so essentially, if we're just talking about free field theory, there are only propagators. There are no vertices. So, as a consequence, essentially, you can't form any connected diagrams except for two-point functions. So to get non-Gaussianity, you basically need interactions. You need vertices that give you things other than propagators. I'll just write this down, then we'll come back. So to get non-Gaussianity, i.e. non-zero connected correlators, higher connected correlators, so higher is just meaning 3, 4, 3 or higher. So to get higher connected correlators, connected three-point functions, 4.56, you need interactions, because these give you vertices. So you don't just have to contract in pairs. If you had a cubic vertex, so if you had 3 points, if we're looking at a three-point function, if we just have free fields, we've only got propagators, so you can connect those two guys, but then you've got one guy left on its own. Whereas if you've got interactions, if you've got a cubic vertex, then you can connect all the points together like this using your cubic vertex. So you can get non-zero higher connected correlators once you have interactions. The other effect of interactions is that they modify the vacuum. If you really want to go and compute what these higher correlators are in inflation, there's two effects you need to take account of. One is you need to work out what are all the interaction vertices. So we saw that in the first couple of lectures, we took the inflationary action, we expanded it to second order in the fluctuations. To get interactions, you need to expand to higher order in the fluctuations. So the leading interaction term will be a cubic term, where you expand out to third order in perturbations. And that will give you cubic vertices like this. So first of all, you need to work out what are the cubic vertices, what are the interaction terms. And there's a second effect you need to take into account of, which is that the interactions modify the vacuum. Very, very, very early times in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, but then the interactions modify the vacuum, taking it into an interacting vacuum. So I won't do any of these calculations today because we simply don't have time, but I just want to sort of point out these two effects. First of all, you get non-trivial vertices, and second, interactions modifying the vacuum state. So this is just like an ordinary quantum field theory. You know, when you remember this Dyson formalism in about chapter 4 of Peskin and Schroeder, you know, once you include interactions, you have to go to this interacting vacuum state. Okay. Yeah, so the point about... So basically the difference between connected and disconnected correlators is that you basically, you know, to form the connected correlators, the general definition will be to take the general correlator and then subtract off all the disconnected factors. So, you know, we would just subtract off zeta q1, zeta q2. Yeah, minus... So in other words, we'd literally just subtract off all the possible disconnected diagrams you could form. But, yeah, that's right. So in terms of actually what you see when you write the algebra is that, you know, disconnected diagrams, they correspond to products of lower point correlators. Okay, yeah, so free fields are Gaussian because you've only got propagators, there's no vertices, you can only contract points together in pairs. When you have interactions, you can have non-Gaussian correlators, you can have non-zero high point connected correlators. So what happens in slow roll? So let's just think about slow roll inflation again. So what happens is basically the slow roll approximation suppresses interactions. Slow roll approximation. How many P's? It's really funny. I used to live in Holland, and then after 5 years in Holland, I can no longer spell words with two P's in, because you see in Dutch, many English words, like say apartment, there's one P or something rather in English, and in Dutch there's two P's. And you know, since living in Holland, I can no longer remember which language has two P's and which has one P. It's very embarrassing. I used to be very good at spelling before that, but kind of wrecks your spelling. Okay, so basically, so the way to see this, so you know, we have the action for perturbation. So we compute the Einstein-Hilbert action for gravity in a scalar field, and we expand it out in the fluctuations. And we did this in the first lecture very briefly. So we saw that basically the quadratic action for zeta, it had an overall factor of the slow roll parameter epsilon in it. Now, this is a fantastic and super hardcore calculation that we're not going to do, but basically it's possible to do the same thing. It's possible to expand out the action to cubic order and work out the term in the interaction. It's possible to work out the term in the action involving three zetas. And you find that when you do this, it's proportional to an overall factor of epsilon squared. If you want to see the full gory details of this calculation, this is a super famous paper by Juan Malvicina. It goes back to... So this was a cutting-edge calculation only 12 years ago. 0210603. Yes, this is, you burn up quite a lot of... You kill quite a lot of trees doing this calculation, so I don't recommend it as a first... Ah. Blackboard malfunction. Yeah, so the point is basically, you know, this cubic term in the action, these are the leading order interaction terms. Of course, there are terms involving four zetas, five zetas, six zetas, but because zeta is small, the leading interactions are basically the cubic terms in zeta. You know, the terms involving four zetas, these are going to be suppressed by a vector factor of zeta. You know, zeta is about 10 to the minus 5, so it's very small. Yeah, so cubic term gives the leading order interactions because zeta is small. Yeah, okay, so remember slow roll was the idea that these slow roll parameters were very small. So you can see that basically the cubic term, which is the leading interaction term, this is suppressed by one factor of epsilon, the slow roll parameter, compared to the quadratic term, which is the term we've been working with so far. So basically, so this is all for single field slow roll inflation. Just put these caveats in. Single field SR slow roll inflation. So basically, because the interaction terms are suppressed by this slow roll approximation, single field slow roll inflation gives you a nearly Gaussian spectrum. So single field inflation, nearly Gaussian. So what we mean by this is that all the higher connected correlators are very, very small. They're suppressed by powers of the slow roll parameter. Let me see. Oh yeah, I was going to say, so in a sense, I suppose one way to think about why slow roll suppresses interactions is easy just to think of things like the inflaton self interaction. So, you know, phi cubed, phi fourth terms that just come from the potential itself. You know, slow roll, we saw yesterday that the slow roll approximation corresponds to having a potential that's very flat. You know, all the derivatives of the potential are very, well, the first and second derivatives of the potential are very small compared to the potential itself. So you can see that, you know, a nearly flat potential is one where all the interaction terms are very small. You know, you may have phi cubed, phi fourth terms in the action, but they come with a very small coefficient. You know, that's necessary for the potential to be nearly flat. So in a sense, you can sort of see intuitively why the slow roll approximation suppresses some of the cubic terms, the ones corresponding to inflaton self-interactions. There are other possible nonlinear terms that just come from expanding the Einstein-Hilbert action out. It's a little bit harder to see why those terms are suppressed by factors of epsilon, but you can sort of see it at a more advanced level how it comes about. But I just want to, the main point is that the slow roll approximation suppresses interactions. That means that single field slow roll inflation is nearly Gaussian. Basically, the three-point function is very small, and all the higher connected correlators are very, very small. So why do we care about non-Gaussianity? And since non-Gaussianity is really interesting, precisely because of this reason, you know, non-Gaussianity tells you about the interaction terms in the inflationary Lagrangian. You know, the thing about inflation, so, you know, it's this beautiful mechanism for explaining why you get perturbations of approximately the right form, but, you know, the key idea in all this is this exponentially expanding geometry, the actual dynamics required to produce this expanding geometry. This is much more uncertain. You know, we work with this idea of a single scalar field and a potential of a particular form, and that's sufficient to produce this exponentially expanding geometry we need. But, you know, it may not be the, you know, up until quite recently, people were interested in many different possibilities, you know, higher derivative kinetic terms, multiple scalar fields driving, you know, you'd have one scalar field driving inflation and then a different scalar field responsible for the perturbations. So, you know, it's sufficient just to consider a single scalar field and a potential, but a priori, there could have been lots of different dynamics that would give you the same accelerating expansion we need to produce the perturbations we see. So in a sense, non-Gaussianity was very interesting, or is very interesting, because it's a good way of telling us about the actual form of the inflationary Lagrangian, the dynamics responsible for producing inflation. Because non-Gaussianity is sensitive to the interaction terms in the inflationary Lagrangian. So in a sense, this is really why we're interested in non-Gaussianity. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of essentially what we did here in a slow and yeah. There's probably, I mean, in a sense, there's fancier ways or slicker ways of sort of seeing it. I mean, essentially, a free quantum field theory is just an infinite collection of harmonic oscillators, and you know, in quantum mechanics, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator is a Gaussian. You know, the wave function the ground state wave function is just a Gaussian. Now, here we're talking about field theory rather than quantum mechanics, so you have to talk about wave functionals rather than wave functions. But basically, for a free field theory, the wave functional of the ground state is a Gaussian, and you know, that the wave functional, you know, the mod squared of the wave functional, that corresponds to the probability distribution. But yeah. Yes, that's right, yes. Exactly, yeah. If you had a... if your wave functional was Gaussian, then when you compute correlators or expectation values using a path integral, that's right, what you get back are exactly these correlates we've been getting here. Yeah, so basically they're sort of synonymous. Free quantum fields in the vacuum state are Gaussian. The vacuum is important because, you know, if we weren't in the vacuum state, then when we hit operators on the state that isn't the vacuum, we don't necessarily get zero. So, so free quantum fields in the vacuum give Gaussian correlates. They're sort of synonymous, that's right. Yeah. So in a sense, you know, the most important point of this lecture is just trying to get across that basic point that free quantum fields in a vacuum are Gaussian, and to get non-Gaussianities, you need interactions, because interactions can give you vertices and hence non-trivial, non-zero connected correlators, higher connected correlators. Yeah, so basically we care about Gaussianity because or non-Gaussianity, because basically deviations from Gaussianity, non-Gaussianity, this tells you about the interaction terms in the inflationary Lagrangian. And this is really fantastic dynamical information that it's hard to see how you could get otherwise. Yeah, so NG non-Gaussianity just tells you about interactions in inflationary Lagrangian. Tells you about the dynamics of what's going on. Not just the kinematics, we know we know it's expanding. What we want to know is what is the mechanism that's driving the expansion? What are the dynamics that's driving it? Right. Yeah, good, okay. So in a sense, so we've seen what a banana is, we've seen what a non-banana is. I'd like to give you quantify it now. You know, we want to quantify how non-banana is a certain object. So how do we quantify non-Gaussianity? So NG is non-Gaussianity from now on. How to quantify non-Gaussianity? Okay, so bear in mind zeta is very small. You know, this perturbation zeta, this co-moving curvature perturbation that we're talking about. So sort of, zeta is related to the temperature fluctuations you see on the CMB by a transfer function, and basically on long wavelengths, you know, zeta is, there's this Sachs-Wolfe effect. I forget what the factor is. Zeta is like 1/3 delta T over T. But basically, you know, the temperature fluctuations we see on the sky, the fractional temperature fluctuations around 10 to the minus 5. So basically, zeta is very small. So basically, you know, the higher order the correlator you look at, the smaller it is. So, you know, the three-point function is suppressed by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 compared to the two-point function. You know, the four-point function is suppressed by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 relative to the three-point function. So higher correlators get small very quickly. So basically, the lowest order correlator, the biggest correlator, the one that's going to be easiest to measure, is just the three-point function. You know, the two-point function, you know, that just tells us about Gaussian statistics. What we want to do is we want to look at the higher correlators to tell us about non-Gaussianity. The biggest higher point correlator is the three-point function. In slightly fancier language, you could say the lowest order statistic basically, you know, if your field were Gaussian, then all higher connected correlators would be zero. The biggest higher correlator is going to be the three-point function, because the higher correlators are suppressed by factors of zeta every time. So the biggest non-Gaussian correlator is the three-point function, at least assuming there's no fancy, you know, in principle there could be things like symmetries that would cause the three-point function to vanish, and then it would be the four-point function as being the next biggest correlator. But assuming there's no, you know, accidents such as symmetries, the biggest non-Gaussian correlator is going to be the three-point function. So because zeta is 10 to the minus 5, high correlators get small. Get smaller. Yeah, so remember, for a Gaussian field, the three-point function will be zero. So if you measure the three-point function, if it were Gaussian, it would be zero. If it's not zero, then you've got a non-Gaussian field, right? So let's see, how do we actually quantify this? Okay, so what does the three-point function look like? We're going to work in momentum space because this is generally, life is generally easiest there. So let's look at the three-point correlator in momentum space. Okay, so basically, So I'll just write it down, then I'll explain. Okay, so the three-point correlated momentum space. First of all, there's a momentum conserving delta function. So this factor here just expresses momentum conservation. So another way of thinking about this is in position space, all your correlators are translation invariant. If I shift all my x coordinates by some constant vector, it doesn't change the correlator. And when you Fourier transform, this gives rise to momentum conservation, these delta functions here. So it's just translation invariance in position space. So another way to think about this is that your three momenta here, you know, Q1, Q2, and Q3, they're going to form a triangle, right? You know, if that were Q1, and let's say that were Q2, then because they've got to sum up to zero, that means Q3 must be like this. So basically, your three momenta form a triangle. They just add up to zero. And okay, then we've got this factor here. And this factor here is what I'm really interested in. So this one here we call the bispectrum. So in a sense, you know, the name is a bit irritating, but basically, you know, the two-point function, the Fourier transform of the two-point function is related to the power spectrum. So the Fourier transform of the three-point function we call the bispectrum. So essentially, I think that's where the name comes from, but it's just a name. So by definition, the bispectrum then is basically the three-point function with the momentum-conserving delta function chopped off. So it's just this factor here. So first of all, these aren't vectors. So the point is that because the background spacetime is homogeneous, and in particular, it's isotropic, we don't actually care, you know, the three-point function, it doesn't care about the orientation of this triangle on the sky. You know, as you rotate this triangle around, you know, it doesn't, the correlator doesn't care. So basically, this bispectrum, because of isotropy of the background, this bispectrum depends only on the magnitudes of the vectors Q. It doesn't depend on the actual direction of the vectors, just their magnitude. So this is a function only of the magnitudes, which are the, just the square roots. So first of all, so it's a function only of the magnitudes, not of the actual vectors themselves, because of isotropy. We don't care about the orientation of the triangle. Let me just... Okay, so just a brief note about how we actually measure this on the sky. So remember, you know, the scalar power spectrum we've been talking about in the earlier lectures, that's a two-point function of zeta, and it's basically related to two-point correlation functions of temperature fluctuations in the CMB. This is a three-point function of zeta, so this is basically related to a three-point correlation function of temperature fluctuations on the CMB. There's a lot more to this story than I'm just giving you a sort of quick overview of the story here. So basically, this bispectrum here, which is basically just a three-point function momentum space with a momentum-conserving delta function lopped off. So basically, this bispectrum, you can measure it from three-point temperature fluctuations of the CMB. So three-point function of CMB temperature fluctuations. Now, there's a lot more to this story than I've been telling you, but basically the idea is that, so we saw that non-Gaussianity, you know, non-zero higher connected correlators, these are due to interactions. Now, there are certainly interactions kicking around during inflation, but there were also non-linearities in the later time evolution of correlation functions. So, for example, you could have non-linearities, you know, because Einstein's equations are non-linear, there's all sorts of sources of non-linearities in your cosmological evolution. You know, if you look at the evolution of perturbation modes in the matter and radiation era, you know, there are going to be non-linearities because Einstein equations are non-linear. So to work out the interaction terms, the non-Gaussianity due to inflation, you basically have to take what you get at late times and subtract off all these other sources of non-Gaussianity to work out the primordial component, you know, basically the bit that's telling you about interactions during inflation. So just to warn you, you have to sort of extract the primordial part. Primordial meaning basically inflationary in this context. By subtracting off all these late time contributions. Or at least you want to be sure that they're going to be smaller than what you're measuring. So there are other sources of nonlinearity, basically nonlinear evolution in the matter and radiation era. There's also nonlinearities in relation between zeta and the temperature fluctuations. So I'm just going to point you to a review. So for example, you could read Komatsu's review on the subject if you're interested. Okay, so basically, morally speaking, the scalar bispectrum, this guy here, the thing we're interested in is measuring non-Gaussianity. You can extract it by looking at three-point correlation functions of temperature fluctuations in the CMB. There's a little bit more to the story than I'm making out, but that's a key idea. Yeah, okay, so just in the last 10 minutes, I just want to tell you a bit more about what this bispectrum looks like. You know, it's a function of three momenta. You know, what sort of shape is it? How do we parameterize this bispectrum? Good, yeah. Okay, so how do we parameterize the bispectrum? Parameterization. Okay, so sort of conventionally, this bispectrum, you know, typically what people do is people split it up into a sort of overall amplitude, then something called a shape function, a function of the shape of the triangle. It's a bit of a faster, loose game, this, but basically you usually write it as some sort of amplitude, which is typically called FNL, and then you have a shape function. I'm just being rather loose here, shape function. So in a sense, the idea of the shape function is, the bispectrum is a function of these three momenta which form a triangle. Basically, there's some overall amplitude, and then there's a function that depends on the shape of the triangle. You know, there's different types of triangle you can have. You can have equilateral triangle. You could have some sort of squeezed triangle where one of the sides is very small compared to the other two. So basically, the shape function is going to tell you about the dependence of the bispectrum on the shape of the triangle. And then there's an overall amplitude that sort of sets the scale of the three-point function. It's a bit of a loose parameterization, this. So in a sense, where this approach is best defined. So as an example of all this, just to try and make this a little bit more concrete, you could look at something called local type non-Gaussianity. NG is non-Gaussianity. So in a sense, this is where this parameterization came from. It's just one example of the, in fact, yeah. So for example, imagine you had a field zeta x. Let's imagine zeta is a Gaussian. So zeta, first of all, has some Gaussian part. And then let's say we can get some non-Gaussian part, which we can think of as one way of getting a non-Gaussian spectrum is to add terms that goes like zeta Gaussian squared here. So let me just write this. So let's say what happens if we did a field redefinition. So we have Gaussian plus some piece that goes as Gaussian squared. So zeta Gaussian squared. Okay, so one way of getting a non-Gaussian field starting from a Gaussian field is to say, let's do a field redefinition. Let's say the field is given by a Gaussian field plus the square of a Gaussian field. And I'm just going to subtract off this piece here. the two-point function of the Gaussian, the idea of this is just a sort of definition, if you like, but I want to do this so that the expectation value of the field stays the same. Okay, so I'm going to do a field redefinition. I'm going to say it's a Gaussian plus a Gaussian field squared, and I'm just going to subtract off the two-point function here like this so that the one-point function vanishes. You know, if you take the expectation value of this, you get expectation of value of that, and then that and that will then cancel out, okay? So that's the point of this term here. Okay, so there's an irritating factor of 3/5 here. This is just a historical accident, right? I mean, when people first wrote this down, they were thinking about the Newtonian potential in the matter era, and basically that happens to be related to zeta here by a factor of 3/5. So essentially, that factor of 3/5 is just some stupid historical accident that would be great if we could erase, but we're stuck with it now. So don't worry too much about that factor. But let's see what happens. What does the three-point function look like if you do this local field redefinition? So local because we're creating some new field just by adding the square of the original field at one point. So this is just a sort of toy example to show you what the bispectrum, what the shape function will look like. If you're really interested in slow on inflation, you have to do this full calculation where you work out the cubic interaction terms and you do your interacting quantum field theory on this curved space-time, and you compute the full three-point function, and you kill a lot of trees, and you get that's how you compute the actual three-point function for slow roll inflation. This is just a sort of toy model. I just want to show you how you can get non-Gaussian correlators just by taking a Gaussian field and adding in its square, and that will give you actually non-Gaussian correlators. So in a sense, it's not this isn't really real physics. This is just a toy model that gives you a non-Gaussian correlators. So in fact, I think it's going to be a homework exercise just to prove then that if you do this, the bispectrum looks like this. Yeah, right, so we get 6/5. Right, yeah. Right, yeah. So this P here is just the power spectrum with a factor of Q cubed. So basically, I'm going to write the power spectrum as Q cubed over 2 pi squared times this P here. I think Matt probably used a similar notation in his lectures. So this is just basically... So in a sense, this is going to be one of your homework exercises. But basically, you know that the three-point function for a Gaussian field vanishes. If you work out the correlator of this new redefined field... and then go to momentum space, work out the bispectrum, you can show that the bispectrum is a product of two-point functions like this. And that factor F and L, this factor here, this just tells you about the overall scale of the bispectrum. It tells you about how large the correlator is. So in fact, you also get higher terms that go as products of three two-point functions, but these terms are smaller because remember, the power spectrum is of order 10 to the minus 9, so I can forget about those terms relative to these terms, which goes the two-point function squared. Okay, so for example, I just want to show what this shape function actually looks like. What if you had scale invariant perturbations? So, for example, for scale invariant perturbations, then you would find that P is just momentum cubed. So P is just some amplitude A times momentum cubed. That amplitude A is just A is just 2 pi squared times the two-point function. But basically, for scaling, have I got that the right way around? I think I don't, do I? It should be minus 3. Good. Yeah, so for scale invariant perturbations, this is just a constant. So that means P goes as momentum to the power of minus 3. If you just plug that in, yes, if you just plug that in, then you find the shape function looks like this. You find the bispectrum so you just have this overall factor of F and L that tells you about the amplitude, and then the momentum dependence is just 1 over Q1 cubed Q2 Q2 cubed, and then all the cyclic permutations, you know, Q2 cubed, Q3 cubed, 1 over Q3 cubed, Q1 cubed. Yeah, so this guy here is what we call the shape function for this local type non-Gaussianity. So this is the shape function for local type non-Gaussianity. So, you know, we split up the bispectrum into an overall factor here that tells you about the amplitude, you know, how big the correlator is, and then there's a shape function that depends on the momentum, you know, depends on the momentum, in other words, the shape of the triangle. So, you know, you can look at this and you get a lot of information, you know, because two-point functions, they don't carry so much information, it's just a function of one momentum. Whereas three-point functions, you've got three momenta that have to form a triangle. So you've got a lot more information in higher point correlation functions. You know, for example, what if one of the momenta was small? What if Q1 goes to zero and you have a squeeze triangle like this? Then you can see that, you know, in the limits where you take one of these momenta to zero, this thing blows up. You know, there's a 1 over Q cubed here and a 1 over Q1 cubed here. So for example, in the squeeze limits where you have triangles where one of the momenta becomes very small, then the shape function becomes very large. So there's a lot of information contained in the shape functions. Okay, so I'm basically out of time, so I just want to summarize. So there's two key points I just want to make, and then I'm done. So one is that in slow roll inflation, so we have a few minutes. So when you do the full calculation, kill all those trees, basically you find that the F and L, which tells you about the amplitude of the three-point function, you find that this is of order the slow roll parameter, so it's very small. So this is just quantifying what we were saying earlier about non-Gaussianity. The interaction terms are very small, so therefore your correlators in inflation are very Gaussian. In other words, the three-point function is very, very small. So the amplitude of the three-point function F and L is of order the slow roll parameters, you know, which is about 10 to the minus 2. So this is just a way of quantifying the statement that slow inflation gives you very Gaussian correlators. The other point I wanted to make briefly, when you actually look at the data, you know, the constraints from the, you know, for example, if you look up the Planck data paper, you can read off constraints for different types of non-Gaussianity. They're usually quoted as constraints on the F and L for certain shape functions. So for example, for local type non-Gaussianity, the parameter is this F and L local we have here. And if you look at the Planck data, you get 2.7. But the error bar is very large, unfortunately. It's 5. Well, relatively large. It's 5.8, 2.7 plus minus 5.8. So basically, you know, from the Planck data at present, you know, we don't have a solid detection of non-Gaussianity. You know, this, because the error bar here is 5.8, this is consistent with zero. So, you know, there should be non-Gaussianity at some level because the evolution is certainly non-linear. But yeah, so basically, when you actually look up the experimental data, you get constraints on non-Gaussianity. They're usually quoted as constraints on the amplitude parameter F and L associated with different shape functions. So there's lots of different shape functions out there, equilateral, for example, orthogonal. But what you actually see quoted in the data are constraints for particular shape functions. Okay, so yeah, so let's just summarize here. So the idea of these last four lectures was we wanted to tell you about perturbations in inflation. And we saw that we saw that simple inflationary models, just like scalar field and potential, let's say a phi squared potential, you know, we saw that with a certain amount of fine-tuning of these slow roll parameters, you know, as long as the potential is suitably flat and the energy scale of inflation is suitably adjusted, we saw that we can get small amplitude perturbations with a nearly scale-invariant power spectrum. And we saw today that these perturbations are nearly Gaussian. In other words, the three-point correlator and all the higher connected correlators are naturally very, very small. So basically, you know, inflationary models, with a certain amount of fine-tuning, they can successfully reproduce these key features we see for the primordial perturbations. And to start to hand over to Dan, the question you should all be thinking about is, you know, what we'd really like is a theory of initial conditions for the universe. You know, why did the inflaton start at the top of the hill? And that's the question that Dan will be telling you about next time. Thank you.